and counsel appointed through our pro bono program. And again, we thank counsel for you and your firm for your services both today and in briefing. And as before, I think counsel for the government also appreciates that sometimes it's easier to address these cases when we do have such excellent briefings. So we thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Kimberly DeMarchi, and I represent the petitioner, Colette Dunton, in this case. When she was a very small child in the first and second years of her education, Colette missed about half of every year of school. And she missed half a year of school because she spent that time being raped and filmed by a ring of child pornographers who had access to her because she was a vulnerable Catholic child living in Northern Ireland during the Catholic Protestant troubles of the 1960s and 1970s, pornographers who selected her particularly because she was a Catholic child and a Catholic child born on a Protestant holiday. Ms. Dunton presented, among other things, a claim that she was eligible for asylum on the basis of her past persecution alone because of its atrocity. The immigration judge did not address this question. The immigration judge did not address whether Ms. Dunton's sexual abuse constituted persecution at all, but rather focused only on the threat that she received from her persecutors years later when she had the courage to report them to a police force that was unwilling to investigate.
What did the government do in the first instance?
By in the first instance, Your Honor, do you mean when she was being abused as a child?
No. Government official participated?
There's significant evidence in the record that at that time in Northern Ireland, the British government was unwilling to investigate allegations of child abuse and particularly child sexual abuse. No, she did not.
So we don't know anything about a government official having anything to do with these.
We do know that some of the abuse that she suffered took place at the Irish estate of a British lord.
Well, yes, if that's the story, but where does the government come in?
My client was a very small child whose parents were unwilling to deal with the prospect of her abuse. Her father was himself a sexual abuser. Her mother, for what reasons we don't know in the record, didn't report the abuse and lied to her school about why she was asking.
It never came to the attention of any government officials.
But what we do know is that in that time period, not just once, but regularly, the British government refused to investigate child sexual abuse and covered it up.
But you know, you have this huge gap here where, as I understand it, you say she's Catholic, she was abused, therefore she was abused on account of because she was Catholic. And you're missing a link to get to the last statement, it seems to me, in terms of government participation.
The most compelling and direct evidence of that is actually the statement of her persecutors. And in many instances, this court has found the direct statements of persecutors to be relevant to motivation. Her persecutors told her that she was special because she was a Catholic child born on a Protestant holiday. They told her, you're special because you're Catholic.
And some of her abusers were Catholic, correct?
The family who initiated her into a ring of persecutors that we can presume included some Protestants because of their access to the home of a prominent Protestant British lord. But the mere fact that some of one's abusers are from one's own religion doesn't mean that the persecution wasn't on account of religion.
No, but the big gap in your thing is you haven't got any connection with any government official. You just can't allege individuals abuse somebody and therefore they're being persecuted.
But police inaction and government inaction to stop abuse by private individuals.
They don't know about it. You have no evidence these people knew, that any official knew anything was going on, assuming the story told by your client is true.
But we do have evidence that the government at that time was unwilling to prohibit this kind of conduct by others.
Oh, it's the vaguest and most general. Well, go ahead. See if you can get any connection. I've read this for you to understand what your case is.
And then the difficulty I have is by the time you get it to a government investigation, both she and the mother decline to participate.
It's not actually clear that she declined to participate.
She was overcome, understandably, and could not assist, let's say. So there you have the government possibly ready to go forward, but they can't go forward on nothing.
Actually, there's quite a bit of evidence in the record about this, and this is one of the things that makes the immigration judge's refusal to listen to any testimony about the police investigation so very troubling on a due process front. In some of her earlier written statements, Ms. Dunton stated that she was told by the police at first that they couldn't find the people who she pointed the finger at, which is fairly implausible given that all Northern Irish are required to register with the police, and so they should know where everyone is. And then later was told that they were located and they were actually living in Ireland. And the police force in Northern Ireland refused to cooperate with the Irish police in order to be able to continue the investigation. So there's evidence in the record that the government was actually unwilling or unable to continue to pursue the investigation once it was discovered that her abusers were living in Ireland. In a later statement, Ms. Dunton mentions the psychological trauma that she experienced in going through with the investigation, the difficulty for her, and this is a woman who, because of the severity of her abuse, suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder. Then the immigration judge gives her no opportunity to explain which of these statements we should place more emphasis on, what the order is of these statements, whether she finds out first that the government won't pursue the people who abused her because they won't cooperate with the police force in that country, or whether she, in fact, abandoned it. There are actually a couple of avenues of relief available to Ms. Dunton in this case, and one of them is the avenue of relief available on the severity of her past persecution alone. As we were discussing a moment before, the government has not contested that the sexual abuse to which Ms. Dunton was subjected would constitute persecution were it motivated on the appropriate ground. And it is also uncontested that the immigration judge didn't address either the severity of that prosecution or the fact that the acts that occurred when she was a child could be a form of persecution. Rather, the immigration judge focused only on the threat that was made against her. And then the immigration judge rested his decision in part on the fact that Ms. Dunton had not demonstrated that the police would be unwilling to protect her from her abusers, who were now threatening to kill her. But again, wouldn't listen to any evidence as to the conduct of the police in dropping the investigation. That alone suggests that a remand for a full and fair hearing would be appropriate. But I would contend to you that my client, even with the limited opportunity that she had to present evidence, was able to demonstrate a well-founded fear for future persecution, and that the INS was unable to rebut the presumption of future persecution by providing evidence that she could relocate. That's really the other important issue in this case. The INS demonstrated only that she had lived in Scotland for some period of time without suffering further persecution. It's important to remember that that period that she lived in Scotland was a period of time before she went to the police and reported her abusers, before her abusers found out where she was living.
You think she'd be persecuted anywhere in the British Isles?
If the British authorities are unwilling or unable to protect her from her abusers, then yes.
Then your theory is that this episode, and it's unfortunate, these are terrible things that happen, but this episode that happened 33 years ago, if she went back to any part of Great Britain, that she would, it's logical, and she's demonstrated she'd be persecuting it again.
While the sexual abuse that happened when she was a child did happen 33 years ago and would itself, because of its severity, be sufficiently atrocious to justify asylum on that basis alone. And there's a case, Lopez Galarza, that says that it doesn't matter whether time has passed since the atrocious persecution. That isn't relevant to its atrocity. The well-founded fear of future persecution is based on the fact not that 33 years ago she was abused, but that she actually went to the police. She was willing to prosecute the people who had abused her, and they know that.
You indicated that she had a relatively easy time in Scotland, but that was before she went to the police. Was it after she went to the police that she went to reside in England?
During the period between going to the police and the threat, she was living some in England. She was traveling fairly extensively.
Is that a yes answer?
It's yes, and also some other countries.
She traveled,
in the United
she
States
traveled,
for some
she
time.
She traveled freely after the investigation came to a halt, did she not?
She did, until she went home for Christmas, and her mom talked about her coming home, and they figured out where she was, and they called her and threatened
her. She did live in England?
She did for some of that time, yes.
And this was after she went to the police?
Yes, but before...
And there's no indication of any threat to her at that time?
No, there's no indication of a threat to her at that time. The threat came after she went, the next time she went home to Northern Ireland.
To Northern Ireland. But there's no indication that she had any problem when she resided in England, in the record.
No, there's not.
Why wouldn't this be sufficient to substantiate the board's position that she can relocate within the country?
I would submit to the court that the fact that her abusers contacted her only when she went home to Northern Ireland to stay with her mother, who had made public in the community that she was coming home, that she was threatened once they could find her. We have no information whether between 1997 and 1999 they had any information about where she was, any ability to find her in order to threaten her and to take further action to carry out their threats.
I don't understand the answer to my question. Under the rules, this is a factual determination by the board. Under the law of the Supreme Court, we have to demonstrate that we're compelled to believe otherwise. Where in the record are we compelled to believe that if she returns to London, she's going to have torture and persecution?
Well, what we know is that the police are unwilling and unable to pursue criminal charges against the people who abused her and who are now threatening her.
We know that will occur in London, England.
We know that it's the British government that won't protect her.
We know that will occur in London, England, from the record.
There's no reason to believe that they couldn't reach her in London, England.
All right.
I've well exceeded my time.
Right, exactly. Why don't we hear from Mr. Verby on behalf of the government?
Again, Your Honors, it's a case with two issues. First, whether Ms. Dutton is entitled to asylum, and second, whether the judge unfairly limited her ability to present her case. Taking the asylum issue first, and starting with the Protestant on Catholic persecution claim, this Court has long held that harassment, although it's morally reprehensible and discrimination, it's terrible, in and of itself is not a basis for asylum in the United States. As for the threatening phone call, the immigration judge correctly determined that an unfulfilled threat without more, while it may be relevant for future persecution claims, it doesn't establish past persecution. In any event, the threat was probably not based, or we don't have any evidence it was based on a protected characteristic. The threat looks as though it was intended more to force Ms. Dutton to drop her criminal investigation and was more akin to witness tampering or obstruction of justice, and ordinary criminal activity is not a basis for asylum either. Turning to the sexual abuse Ms. Dutton suffered, it was harmful and it was tragic, and no one denies that, but there's no indication that it was perpetrated on account of a protected characteristic, nor is there any evidence that it was perpetrated by anyone within the government or that the government is unwilling or unable to protect Ms. Dutton from her would-be persecutors. As again, she never reported these incidents. We have no evidence that the British government is unwilling or unable to protect her. But the immigration judge did enter an alternative finding that even if she did suffer past persecution, the government rebutted the presumption of well-founded persecution by showing she could move to another part of the United Kingdom. She lived in Scotland for 7 years without incident. She lived also in England for a period of time without incident. So we believe that the Board of Immigration Appeals and the immigration judge had it right in this case, and we ask that the findings be affirmed and the petition for review be denied. If there are no further questions, that concludes.
I have none. If you need a moment for rebuttal, we will give you a minute, but I think we have your argument in mind, but you're welcome to take a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just one additional point. The threat itself was actually on a protected ground. Number one, if the abuse 33 years ago was on a protected ground and the threat was in order to keep that abuse secret, to keep that abuse from forming the grounds of prosecution for the abusers, that would be on a protected ground. And since then, Ms. Dunton married a Protestant, and one of the things that her abuser mentioned during the threat was that he would send her to join her dead Protestant husband, creating additional evidence that it was a threat on a protected ground of religion and arguably the political opinion or religious opinion of engaging in a mixed marriage. Thank you. I appreciate it.
I'd like to ask you, I don't understand our pro bono program, but how did you get this case, in effect?
My understanding is that the staff attorneys select cases as eligible for the pro bono program, and then there are a group of regional coordinators, volunteer attorneys in various cities.
So our staff selected this case, and they sent it to Arizona? Is that...
Yes. My understanding is the cases usually go to the place where the facts arose. My client lives in southern Arizona and was in front of an immigration judge.
After the selection of this case, it goes there, and then how does it get to you?
There's a volunteer attorney at a law firm in Phoenix who rounds up volunteers, basically, to take these cases. My understanding, actually, in addition to the staff attorneys picking the cases, is that pro se petitioners can request inclusion in the program, and I believe my client did so.
And then did you volunteer, or how did you get into it?
I volunteered. My firm has an established relationship with the pro bono program. We take a few cases a year at least, and the coordinator in our area knows that, so he calls us up and tells us when he has a case.
Thank you. And thank you for your assistance. Case of Dunton versus Ashcroft is submitted.
Sure.
The next case for argument is Davis versus Ignacio. Sure.
Just making decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And the staff.
Yeah. This one was.
Was that right?